Ingwe founded the Ingwaiwa 20. This name is certainly to be equated with Ingwayones, see above, and the invasion of the Ingwaiwa, or Sons of Ing, equally certainly represents the Anglo-Saxon invasion of Britain. Can Ingwe be equated? So far as this present material is concerned, I hardly see how they cannot be. Whether this ancestor founder is to be equated with Ingwe, whose son was Ingil of the Lost Tales, is another question. It is hard to believe that there is no connection, especially since Ingwe in the Cottage of Lost Play is emended from Ing, 1:22. Yet it is equally difficult to see what that connection could be, since Ingwe of the Lost Tales is an elder of Kor, Ingwe, Lord of the Vanyar in the Silmarillion, while Ingwe of the Alfwine story is a man, the king of Luthany and Alfwine's ancestor. In outlines for Gilfanan's tale, it is said that Ing, king of Luthany, was descended from Ermon, or from Ermon and Elmir, the first men, 1:236-7. The following outlines tell some more concerning Ingwe and the Ingwaiwar. 22. How Ing sailed away at eld, that is, in old age, into the twilight, and men say he came to the gods, but he dwells on Tol Eressëa, and will guide the fairies one day back to Luthany when the faring forth takes place. Footnote, the term faring forth is used here in a prophetic sense, not as it is in 18 and 20. End of footnote. How he prophesied that his kin should fare back again and possess Luthany until the days of the coming of the elves. How the land of Luthany was 7 times invaded by men, until at the 7th the children of Ing came back to their own. How at each new war and invasion the elves faded, and each loved the elves less, until the Rumhorth came, and they did not even believe they existed, and the elves all fled, so that save for a few the isle was empty of the elves for 300 years. 23. How Ingwe drank Limpe at the hands of the elves and reigned ages in Luthany. How Eärendil came to Luthany to find the elves gone. How Ingwe aided him, but was not suffered to go with him. Eärendil blessed all his progeny as the mightiest sea rovers of the world. Note 16. Compare page 264, Roman numeral 14. End of note. How Osser made war upon Ingwe because of Eärendil, and Ing, longing for the elves, set sail, and all were wrecked after being driven far east. How Ing the Immortal came among the Dani Orodani Urdainoth East Danes. How he became the half-divine king of the Ingwaiwar, and taught them many things of elves and gods, so that some true knowledge of the gods and elves lingered in that folk alone. Part of another outline that does not belong with the foregoing passages, but covers the same part of the narrative as 23, may be given here. 24. Eärendil takes refuge with Ingwe from the wrath of Osse, and gives him a draught of limpe enough to assure immortality. He gives him news of the elves and the dwelling on Tol Eressëa. Ingwe and a host of his folk set sail to find Tol Eressëa, but Osse blows them back east. They are utterly wrecked, only Ingwe rescued on a raft. He becomes king of the Angali, Euti, Saxani, and Firisandi, footnote, Angles, Saxons, Jutes, and Frisians, end of footnote, who adopt the title of Ingwaiwar. He teaches them much magic and first sets men's hearts to seafaring westward. After a great, age of rule, in brackets, Ingwe sets sail in a little boat and is heard of no more. It is clear that the intrusion of Luthany and Ingwe into the conception has caused a movement in the story of Eärendil. Whereas in the older version he went to Tol Eressëa after the departure of the Eldar and Noldali from the Great Lands, pages 253-255, now he goes to Luthany, and the idea of Osse's enmity towards Eärendil, pages 254-263, is retained but brought into association with the origin of the Ingwaiwar. It is clear that the narrative structure is Ingwe, king of Luthany. Eärendil seeks refuge with him after many of the elves have departed to Tol Eressëa. Ingwe seeks Tol Eressëa but is driven into the east. 7 invasions of Luthany. The people of Ingwe are the Ingwaiwar, and they come back to their own when they invade Luthany from across the North Sea. 25. Luthany was where the tribes first embarked in the lonely isle for Valinor, and whence they landed for the faring forth, whence also many sailed with Elwing to find Tolaresia. Footnote. Faring forth, in the sense of the march of the elves from Cor, as in 18 and 20. End of footnote. That Luthany was where the elves, at the end of the great journey from Polysor, embarked on the lonely isle for the ferrying to Valinor, is probably to be connected with the statement in 20 that Ingwe and Earendel dwelt in Luthany before it was an isle. 26. There are other references to the channel separating Luthany from the great lands. In rough jottings in Notebook C, there is mention of an isthmus being cut by the elves, fearing men now that Ingwe has gone, and to the white cliffs where the silver spades of the Teleri worked, also in the next citation. 27. The elves tell Alfwina of the ancient manor of Luthany, of Cortirion or Gwarthirion, Caer Gwar, of Tavrobo. Note 17. Caer Gwar, see page 292, end of note. How the fairies dwelt there 100 ages before men had the skill to build boats to cross the channel, so that magic lingers yet mightily in its woods and hills. How they renamed many a place in Tolaresia after their home in Luthany. Of the second faring forth, and the fairies hoped to reign in Luthany and replant there the magic trees. And it depends most on the temper of the men of Luthany, since they first must come there, whether all goes well. Notable here is the reference to the second faring forth, which strongly supports my interpretation of the expression faring forth in 18, 20, and 25. But the prophecy or hope of the elves concerning the faring forth has been greatly changed from its nature in citation 6. Here the trees are to be replanted in Luthany. 28. How Alfwina lands in Tolaresia, and it seems to him like his own land made, Lacuna, clad in the beauty of a happy dream. How the folk comprehended his speech, and learn whence he is come by the favor of Ulmo, how he is sped to Cortirion. With these two passages, it is interesting to compare 9, the prose preface to Cortirion among the trees, according to which Cortirion was a city built by the elves in Tolaresia. And when Tolaresia was brought across the sea, becoming England, Cortirion was renamed in the tongue of the English Warwick, 13. In the new story, Cortirion is likewise an ancient dwelling of the elves, but with the change in the fundamental conception, it is in Luthany, and the Cortirion to which Alfwina comes in Tolaresia is the second of the name, being called after their home in Luthany. There has thus been a very curious transference, which may be rendered schematically thus. 1. Cortirion, elvish dwelling in Tolaresia. Tolaresia becomes England. Cortirion equals Warwick. 2. Cortirion, elvish dwelling in Luthany, replaced by England. Elves settle in Tolaresia. Cortirion 2 in Tolaresia, named after Cortirion 1 in Luthany. On the basis of the foregoing passages, 15 to 28, we may attempt to construct a narrative taking account of all the essential features. March of the Elves of Cor, called the Faring Forth, or, by implication in 27, the first Faring Forth, into the Great Lands, landing in Luthany, 25, and the loss of Valinor, 18. War with evil men in the Great Lands, 18. The Elves retreated to Luthany, not yet an island, where Ingwe, was king, 18-20. Many, but by no means all, of the elves of Luthany sought back west over the sea and settled in Tolaresia, but Elwing was lost, 18-25. Places in Tolaresia were named after places in Luthany, 27. Earendel came to Luthany taking refuge with Ingwe, from the hostility of Ossé, 20-23-24. Earendel gave Ingwe limpe to drink, 24, or Ingwe received limpe from the elves before Earendel came, 23. Earendel blessed the progeny of Ingwe before his departure, 23. Ossé's hostility to Earendel pursued Ingwe, also 23-24. Ingwe set sail with many of his people, 24, to find Tolaresia, 23-24. Ingwe instructed the Ingwaiwar in true knowledge of the gods and elves, 23, and turned their hearts to seafaring westwards, 24. He prophesied that his kin should one day return again to Luthany, 22. Ing Ingwe at length departed in a boat, 2224, and was heard of no more, 24, or came to Tolaresia, 22. After Ing Ingwe's departure from Luthany, a channel was made so that Luthany became an isle, 26, but men crossed the channel in boats, 27. Seven successive invasions took place, including that of the Rumhoth, or Romans, and at each new war, more of the remaining elves of Luthany fled over the sea, 2022. The seventh invasion, that of the Ingwaiwar, was, however, not hostile to the elves, 2021. And these invaders were coming back to their own, 22, since they were the people of Ing, Ingwe. The elves of Luthany, now England, throve again and ceased to leave Luthany for Tol Laresia, 19. And they spoke to the Ingwaiwar in their own language, Old English, 21. Alfwina was an Englishman of the Anglo-Saxon period, a descendant of Ing, Ingwe, who had derived a knowledge of and love of the elves from the tradition of his family, 1516. Alfwina came to Tolaresia, found that Old English was spoken there, and was called by the elves Luthien, friend, the man of Luthany, the Isle of Friendship, 1516-19. I claim no more for this than that it seems to me to be the only way in which these disjecta membra can be set together into a comprehensive narrative scheme. It must be admitted even so that it requires some forcing of the evidence to secure apparent agreement. For example, there seems to be different views of the relation of the Ingwaiwar to Ing, Ingwe. They are the sons of Ing, 19, his kin, 22, the children of the children of Ing, 22. Yet he seems to have become the king and teacher of North Sea peoples, who had no connection with Luthany or the elves, 23-24. Over whom did he rule when the elves first retreated to Luthany, 18-23? Again, it is very difficult to fit the 100 ages during which the elves dwelt in Luthany before the invasion of men began, 27, to the rest of the scheme. Doubtless in these jottings my father was thinking with his pen, exploring independent narrative paths. One gets the impression of a ferment of ideas and possibilities rapidly displacing one another, from which no one stable narrative core can be extracted. A complete solution is therefore in all probability an unreal aim, and this reconstruction no doubt as artificial as that attempted earlier for the Ariel story, see page 293. But here, as there, I believe that this outline shows as well as can be the direction of my father's thought at that time. There is very little to indicate the further course of the Alfwina story. After his sojourn in Tolaresia, as I have remarked, page 301, the part of the mariner is only to learn and record tales out of the past. And virtually all that can be learned from these notes is found on a slip that reads, 29. How Alfwina drank of Limpe, but thirsted for his home, and went back to Luthany. And thirsted then unquenchably for the elves, and went back to Tovrobel the old, and dwelt in the house of the 100 chimneys, where grows still the child of the child of the pine of Belorin, and wrote the golden book. Associated with this is a title page, 30, The Book of Lost Tales and the History of the Elves of Luthany, being, in brackets, the Golden Book of Tovrobel. The same that Alfwino wrote and laid in the house of 100 chimneys at Tovrobel, where it lieth still to read for such as may. These are very curious. Tovrobel the Old must be the original Tovrobel in Luthany, after which Tovrobel in Tolaresia was named, just as Corterion in Tolaresia was named after Corterion equals Warwick in Luthany. And the House of the 100 chimneys, as also the Pine of Belorin, on which, see page 281 and note 4, was to be displaced from Tolaresia to Luthany. Presumably my father intended to rewrite those passages in the framework of the Lost Tales, where the House of 100 chimneys in Tovrobel is referred to. Unless there was to be another House of 100 chimneys in Tovrobel the New in Tolaresia. Lastly, an interesting entry in the Kenya Dictionary may be mentioned here. Harma Kuluanen, the Golden Book, the collected book of legends, especially of Ing and Earendel. In the event all of these projections, my father only developed the story of Alfwina's youth and his voyage to Tolaresia to a full and polished form, and to this work I now turn. But first, it is convenient to collect the passages previously considered that bear on it. In the opening link to the tale of Tenuvial, Ariol said that many years agone, when he was a child, his home was in an old town of men girt with a wall now crumbled and broken, and a river ran thereby over which a castle with a great tower hung. My father came of a coastward folk, and the love of the sea that I had never seen was in my bones, and my father whetted my desire, for he told me tales that his father had told him before. Now my mother died in a cruel and hungry siege of that old town, and my father was slain in bitter fight about the walls, and in the end I, Ariol, escaped to the shoreland of the western sea. Ariol told then of his wanderings about the western havens, of how he was wrecked upon far western islands, until at last upon one lonely one he came upon an ancient sailor who gave him shelter, and over a fire within his lonely cabin told him strange tales of things beyond the western seas, of the magic isles and that most lonely one that lay beyond. Ever after, said Ariel, did I sail more curiously about the western isles, seeking more stories of the kind. And thus it is indeed that after many great voyages I came myself by the blessing of the gods to Tolaresia in the end. In the typescript version of this link, it is further told that in the town where Ariol's parents lived and died, there dwelt a mighty duke, and did he gaze from the topmost battlements, never might he see the bounds of his wide domain, save where far to east the blue shapes of the great mountains lay. Yet was that tower held the most lofty that stood in the lands of men. The siege and sack of the town were the work of the wild men from the mountains of the east. At the end of the typescript version, the boy Ausir assured Ariol that that ancient mariner beside the lonely sea was none other than Ulmo's self, who appeareth not seldom thus to those voyagers whom he loves. But Ariol did not believe him. I have given above, pages 294-5, reasons for thinking that in the Ariol story, this tale of his youth was not set in England. Turning to the passages concerned with the later Alfwina story, we learn from 15 that Alfwina dwelt in the southwest of England, and that his mother and father were slain by the sea pirates, and from 20 that they were slain by the fierce men of the sea, from 16 that he was driven by the Normans. In 15 there is a mention of his meeting with the ancient mariner during his voyages. In 16 he comes to the harbor of the southern shore of Tolaresia, and in 17 he awakens upon a sandy beach at low tide. I come now to the narrative that finally emerged. It will be observed, perhaps with relief, that Ing Ingwe and the Ing Waiwar have totally disappeared. Alfwina of England. There are three versions of this short work. One is a plot outline of less than 500 words, which for convenience of reference I shall call Alfwina A. But the second is a much more substantial narrative bearing the title Alfwina of England. This was written in 1920 or later, demonstrably not earlier, for my father used for it scraps of paper pinned together, and some of these are letters to him all dated in February 1920. Note 18. It may be mentioned here that when my father read The Fall of Gondolin to the Exeter College Essay Club in the spring of 1920, the mariner was still Ariol, as appears from the notes for his preliminary remarks on that occasion. See Unfinished Tales, page 5. He said here, very strangely, that Ariol lights by accident on the lonely island. End of note. The third text no doubt began as a fair copy in ink of the second, to which it is indeed very close at first, but became, as it proceeded, a complete rewriting at several points, with the introduction of much new matter, and it was further emended after it had been completed. It bears no title in the manuscript, but must obviously be called Alfwina of England likewise. For convenience, I shall refer to the first fully written version as Alfwina 1, and to its rewriting as Alfwina 2. The relation of Alfwina A to these is hard to determine, since it agrees in some respects with the one and in some with the other. It is obvious that my father had Alfwina 1 in front of him when he wrote Alfwina 2, but it seems likely that he drew on Alfwina A at the same time. I give here the full text of Alfwina 2 in its final form, with all noteworthy emendations and all important differences from the other texts in the notes. Differences in names and changes to names are listed separately. There was a land called England, and it was an island of the west, and before it was broken in the warfare of the gods, it was westernmost of all the northern lands, and looked upon the great sea that men of old called Garsage. Note 19. G-A-R-S-E-C-G, pronounced Garsage, spelled G-A-R-S-E-D-G-E, and so written in Alfwena A, was one of the many old English names of the sea. End of note. But that part that was broken was called Ireland, and many names besides, and its dwellers come not into these tales. All that land the elves named Luthien, and do so yet. Note 20. In Alfwena 1, the land is likewise named Luthien, not Luthany. In Alfwena A, on the other hand, the same distinction is made as in the outlines. Alfwena of England, whom the fairies after named Luthien, friend of Luthany, friendship. At this first occurrence only of Luthien in Alfwena 2, the form Lathian is penciled above, but Luthien is not struck out. The Lay of Lathian was afterwards the title of the long poem of Beren and Luthien Tenuvial. End of note. In Luthien alone dwelt still the most part of the fading companies, the holy fairies that have not yet sailed away from the world, beyond the horizon of men's knowledge, to the lonely island, or even to the hill of Toon upon the bay of Faerie that washes the western shores of the kingdom of the gods. Note 21. The hill of Toon, that is, the hill on which the city of Toon was built, see page 292, end of note. Therefore is Luthien even yet a holy land, and a magic that is not otherwise lingers still in many places of that isle. Now amidmost of that island is there still a town that is aged among men, but its age among the elves is greater far, and for this is a book of the lost tales of Elfinesse, it shall be named in their tongue Cortirion, which the gnomes call Mindon Gwar. Note 22. Mindon Gwar, see page 291, end of note. Upon the hill of Gwar dwelt in the days of the English a man, and his name was Deor. And he came thither from afar, from the south of the island, and from the forests, and from the enchanted west, where, albeit he was of the English folk, he had long time wandered. Now the prince of Gwar was in those days a lover of songs, and no enemy of the elves. And they lingered yet most of all the isle in those regions about Cortirion, which places they call Alal Minore, the land of elms. And thither came Deor the singer to seek the prince of Gwar, and to seek the companies of the fading elves, for he was an elf friend. Though Deor was of English blood, it is told that he wedded to wife a maiden from the west, from Lyonesse, as some have named it since, or Evadrian, coast of iron, as the elves still say. Deor found her in the lost land beyond Valerion, whence the elves at times set sail. Myrth had Deor long time in Mindon Gwar, but the men of the north, whom the fairies of the island called Forodwife, but whom men called other names, came against Gwar in those days when they ravaged well-nigh all the land of Luthien. Its walls availed not, and its towers might not withstand them for ever, though the siege was long and bitter. There Eadgifu, or so did Deor name the Maiden of the West, though it was not her name aforetime, died in those evil, hungry days. Note 23. Eadgifu, in the Ariel story, this old English name, see page 323, was given as an equivalent to Nymi, Ariel's wife whom he wedded in Tolaresia, page 290, end of note. But Deor fell before the walls even as he sang a song of ancient valor for the raising of men's hearts. That was a desperate sally, and the son of Deor was Alfwena, and he was then but a boy left fatherless. The sack of that town thereafter was very cruel, and whispers of its ancient days alone remained, and the elves that had grown to love the English of the isle fled or hid themselves for a long time, and none of elves or men were left in his old halls to lament the fall of Oswina, prince of Gwar. Then Alfwena, even he whom the unfated elves beyond the waters of Garsage did after name Eldiron of Luthien, which is Alfwena of England, was made a thrall to the fierce lords of the Forodwife, and his boyhood knew evil days. But behold a wonder, for Alfwena knew not and had never seen the sea. Yet he heard its great voice speaking deeply in his heart, and its murmurous choirs sang ever in his secret ear between wake and sleep that he was filled with longing. This was of the magic of Eod Gifu, maiden of the West, his mother, and this longing unquenchable had been hers all the days that she dwelt in the quiet inland places among the elms of Mindongwa. And amidmost of her longing was Alfwina, her child-born, and the foam riders, the elves of the sea marge, whom she had known of old in Leonessa, sent messengers to his birth. But now Eod Gifu was gone beyond the rim of earth, and her fair form lay unhonored in Mindongwa, and Deor's harp was silent. But Alfwina labored in thraldom until the threshold of manhood, dreaming dreams and filled with longing, and at rare times holding converse with the hidden elves. At last his longing for the sea bit him so sorely that he contrived to break his bonds, and daring great perils and suffering many grievous toils, he escaped to lands where the lords of the Forodwife had not come, far from the place of Deor's abiding in Mindongwa. Ever he wandered southward and to the west, for that way his feet unbidden led him. Now Alfwina had in a certain measure the gift of elfin sight, which was not given to all men in those days of the fading of the elves, and still less is it granted now. And the folk of Luthien were less faded too in those days, so that many a host of their fair companies he saw upon his wandering road. Some there were dwelt yet, and danced yet about that land as of old. But many more there were that wandered slowly and sadly westward. For behind them all the land was full of burnings and of war, and its dwellings ran with tears and with blood for the little love of men for men. Nor was that the last of the takings of Luthien by men from men, which have been seven, and others mayhap still shall be. Men of the east and of the west and of the south and of the north have coveted that land and dispossessed those who held it before them, because of its beauty and goodliness, and of the glamour of the fading ages of the elves that lingered still among its trees beyond its high white shores. Note 24. In Alfwina 1, the text here reads, "By reason of her beauty and goodliness, even as that king of the Franks that was upon a time most mighty among men hath said, sic." In Alfwina 2, the manuscript in ink stops at "high white shores." But after these words my father penciled in, "Even as that king of the Franks that was in those days the mightiest of earthly kings hath said, sic." The only clue in Alfwina of England to the period of Alfwina's life is the invasion of the Forodwife, Vikings. The mighty king of the Franks may therefore be Charlemagne, but I have been unable to trace any such reference. End of note. Yet at each taking of that isle have many more of the most ancient of all dwellers therein, the folk of Luthien, turned westward. And they have got them in ships at Valerion in the west, and sailed thence away forever over the horizon of men's knowledge, leaving the island the poorer for their going, and its leaves less green. Yet still it abides the richest among men in the presence of the elves. And it is said that save only when the fierce fathers of men, foes of the elves, being new come under the yoke of evil, entered first that land, never else did so great a concourse of elfin ships and white-winged galleons sail to the setting sun as in those days when the ancient men of the south set first their mighty feet upon the soil of Luthien. The men whose lords sat in the city of power that elves and men have called Rum, but the elves alone do know as Mugbar. Note 25, the yoke of evil. Evil is emended from Melko. Alfwina 1 does not have the phrase. End of note. Note 26, but the elves alone do know as Magbar. Alfwina 1 has, "When the ancient men of the south from Mikuljeard, the heartless town, set their mighty feet upon the soil of Luthien." This text does not have the reference to Rum and Magbar. The name Mikuljeard, Mikuljeard, is struck through, but Mikuljeard, Mikuljeard, is written at the head of the page. Mikuljeard is Old English, and Mikuljeard a modernization of this in spelling, though it does not occur in extant Old English writings and is modeled on Old Norse Miklejardr, Constantinople. The peculiar hostility of the Romans to the elves of Luthany is mentioned by implication in citation 20, and their disbelief in their existence in 22. End of note. Now is it the dull hearts of later days, rather than the red deeds of cruel hands, that set the minds of the little folk to fare away. And ever and anon a little ship weighs anchor from Beleriand at eve, and its sweet sad song is lost forever on the waves. Note 27. The application frequent in Alfwena 1 of little to the fairies, elves of Luthien, and their ships, was retained in Alfwena 2 as first written, but afterwards struck out. Here the word is twice retained, perhaps unintentionally. End of note. Yet even in the days of Alfwena there was many a laden ship under elfin sails that left those shores forever, and many a comrade he had, seen or half unseen, upon his westward road. And so he came at last to Beleriand, and there he laved his weary feet in the grey waters of the western sea, whose great roaring drowned his ears. There the dim shapes of elvish boats sailed by him in the gloaming, and many aboard called to him farewell. 28. Elvish is a later emendation of fairy. End of note. But he might not embark on those frail craft, and they refused his prayer, for they were not willing that even one beloved among men should pass with them beyond the edge of the west, or learn what lies far out on Garsage, the great and measureless sea. Now the men who dwelt thinly about those places nigh Beleriand were fishermen, and Alfwena abode long time amongst them. And being of nature shaped inly thereto, he learned all that a man may of the craft of ships and of the sea. He recked little of his life, and he set his ocean paths wider than most of those men, good mariners though they were. And there were few in the end who dared to go with him, save Alfhear the fatherless, who was with him in all ventures until his last voyage. Note 29. This sentence from Save Alfhear was added later in Alfwena 2. It is not in Alfwena 1. The whole text of this point in Alfwena 1 and 2 is compressed into the following in Alfwena A. Alfwena of England, whom the fairies after named Luthien, friend of Luthany, friendship, born of Deor and Eadgifu. Their city burned and Deor slain, and Eadgifu dies. Alfwena a thrall of the winged helms. He escapes to the western sea and takes ship from Beleriand and makes great voyages. He is seeking for the islands of the west, of which Eadgifu had told him in his childhood. End of note. Now on a time journeying far out into the open sea, being first becalmed in a thick mist, and after driven helpless by a mighty wind from the east, he espied some islands lying in the dawn, but he won not ever thereto, for the winds changing swept him again far away, and only his strong fate saved him to see the black coasts of his abiding once again. Little content was he with his good fortune, and purposed in his heart to sail some time again yet further into the west. Thinking unwitting, it was the magic isles of the songs of men that he had seen from afar. Few companions could he get for this adventure. Not all men love to sail a quest for the red sun, or to tempt the dangerous seas in thirst for undiscovered things. Seven such found he, in the end, the greatest mariners that were then in England. And Ulmo, lord of the sea, afterward took them to himself, and their names are now forgotten, save Alfhear only. Note 30. Alfwena 1 has here, but three men could he find as his companions, and Osser took them under him. Osser was emended to Naor, and then the sentence was struck through and rewritten, such found he only three, and those three Naor after took under him, and their names are not known. Naor equals Ulmo, see note 39. End of note. A great storm fell upon their ship, even as they had sighted the isles of Alfwena's desire, and the great sea swept over her. But Alfwena was lost in the waves, and coming to himself saw no sign of ship or comrades, and he lay upon a bed of sand in a deep-walled cove. Dark and very empty was the isle, and he knew then that these were not those magic isles of which he had heard often tell. Note 31, Alfwena A reads, he espies some islands lying in the dawn, but is swept thence by great winds. He returns hardly to Beleriand. He gathers the seven greatest mariners of England. They sail in spring. They are wrecked upon the isles of Alfwena's desire, and find them desert and lonely and filled with gloomy, whispering trees. This is at variance with Alfwena 1 and 2, where Alfwena is cast onto the island alone. but agrees with two in giving Alfwina seven companions, not three. End of note. There wandering long, 'tis said, he came upon many hulls of wrecks rotting on the long gloomy beaches, and some were wrecks of many mighty ships of old, and some were treasure-laden. A lonely cabin looking westward he found at last upon the further shore, and it was made of the upturned hull of a small ship. An ancient man dwelt there, and Alfwina feared him, for the eyes of the man were as deep as the unfathomable sea, and his long beard was blue and grey. Great was his stature, and his shoes were of stone, but he was all clad in tangled rags, sitting beside a small fire of drifted wood. Note 32. A clue that this was Ulmo. Compare The Fall of Gondolin, page 155. He was shod with mighty shoes of stone. End of note. In that strange hut beside an empty sea did Alfwina long abide for lack of other shelter or of other counsel, thinking his ship lost and his comrades drowned. But the ancient man grew kindly towards him, and questioned Alfwina concerning his coming and his goings, and whither he had desired to sail before the storm took him. And many things before unheard did Alfwina hear tell of him beside that smoky fire at eve. And strange tales of wind-harried ships and harbourless tempests in the forbidden waters. Thus heard Alfwina how the magic isles were yet a great voyage before him, keeping a dark and secret ward upon the edge of earth, beyond whom the waters of Garsedge grow less troublous, and there lies the twilight of the latter days of fairyland. Beyond and on the confines of the shadows lies the lonely island looking east to the magic archipelago and to the lands of men beyond it, and west into the shadows beyond which afar off is glimpsed the outer land, the kingdom of the gods. Even the aged Bay of Faery, whose glory has grown dim. Thence slopes the world steeply beyond the rim of things to Valinor, that is God-home, and to the wall, and to the edge of nothingness, whereon are sown the stars. But the lonely isle is neither of the great lands, or of the outer land, and no isle lies near it. In his tales that aged man named himself the Man of the Sea, and he spoke of his last voyage ere he was cast in wreck upon this outer isle, telling how ere the west wind took him he had glimpsed afar off, bosomed in the deep, the twinkling lanterns of the lonely isle. Then did Alfwina's heart leap within him. But he said to that aged one that he might not hope to get him a brave ship or comrades more. But that man of the sea said, "Lo, this is one of the ring of harbourless isles that draw all ships towards their hidden rocks and quaking sands, lest men fare over far upon Garsedge and see things that are not for them to see. And these isles were set here at the hiding of Valinor, and little wood for ship or raft does there grow on them, as may be thought. But I may aid thee yet in thy desire to depart from these greedy shores." Note 33. In Alfwina A, they were filled with gloomy, whispering trees. Note 31. End of note. Thereafter, on a day, Alfwina fared along the eastward strands, gazing at the many unhappy wrecks there lying. He sought, as often he had done before, if he might see perchance any sign or relic of his good ship from Valerion. There had been that night a storm of great violence and dread, and lo, the number of wrecks was increased by one, and Alfwina saw it had been a large and well-built ship of cunning line, such as the Forodwife then loved. Cast far up on the treacherous sands it stood, and its great beak carven as a dragon's head still glared unbroken at the land. Then went the man of the sea out when the tide began to creep in, slow and shallow, over the long flats. He bore as a staff a timber great as a young tree, and he fared as if he had no need to fear tide or quicksand, until he came far out where his shoulders were scarce above the yellow waters of the incoming flood to that carven prow, and now alone was seen above the water. Then Alfwina marveled, watching from afar, to see him heave by his single strength the whole great ship up from the clutches of the sucking sand that gripped its sunken stern. And when it floated, he thrust it before him, swimming now with mighty strokes in the deepening water. At that sight, Alfwina's fear of the aged one was renewed, and he wondered what manner of being he might be. But now the ship was thrust far up on the firmer sands, and the swimmer strode ashore, and his mighty beard was full of strands of seaweed, and seaweed was in his hair. And that tide again forsook the hungry sands, the man of the sea bade Alfwina go look at that new-come wreck. And going, he saw it was not hurt. But there were within 9 dead men who had not long ago been yet alive. They lay abottom, gazing at the sky. And behold, one whose garb and mien still proclaimed a chieftain of men lay there. Although his locks were white with age and his face was pale in death, still a proud man and a fierce he looked.
"Men of the north, or Odwife, are they," said the man of the sea, "but hunger and thirst was their death, and their ship was flung by last night's storm where she stuck in the hungry sands, slowly to be engulfed, had not fate thought otherwise." "Truly do you say of them, O man of the sea, and him I know well with those white locks, for he slew my father, and long was I his thrall, and Orm men called him, and little did I love him." "And his ship shall it be that bears you from this harbourless isle," said he. "And a gallant ship it was of a brave man, for few folk have now so great a heart for the adventures of the sea as have these for Odwife, who press ever into the mists of the west, though few live to take back tale of all they see." Thus it was that Alfwina escaped beyond hope from that island, for the man of the sea was his pilot and steersman, and so they came after a few days to a land but little known. Note 34. From the point where the man of the sea said, "Lo, this is one of the ring of harbourless isles," page 317, to here, that is, the whole episode of the foundered Viking ship and its captain Orm, slayer of Alfwina's father, there is nothing corresponding in Alfwina 1, which has only, "But that man of the sea aided him in building a little craft, and together, guided by the solitary mariner, they fared away and came to a land but little known." For the narrative in Alfwina A, see note 39. End of note. "And the folk that dwell there are a strange folk, and none know how they came thither in the west. Yet are they accounted among the kindreds of men, albeit their land is on the outer borders of the regions of mankind, lying yet further toward the setting sun beyond the harbourless isles, and further to the north than is that isle whereon Alfwina was cast away. Marvellously skilled are these people in the building of ships and boats of every kind, and in the sailing of them. Yet do they fare seldom or never to the lands of other folk, and little do they busy themselves with commerce or with war. Their ships they build for love of that labor, and for the joy they have only to ride the waves in them. And the great part of that people are ever aboard their ships, and all the water about the island of their home is ever white with their sails in calm or storm. Their delight is to vie in rivalry with one another with their boats of surpassing swiftness, driven by the winds or by the ranks of their long-shafted oars. Other rivalries have they with ships of great seaworthiness, for with these will they contest who will weather the fiercest storms. And these are fierce indeed about that isle, and it is iron-coasted save for one cool harbour in the north. Thereby is the craft of their shipwrights proven. And these people are called by men the Uselings, the children of the waves. But the elves call the island Eneadur, and its folk the shipmen of the west. Note 35, Uselings. At one occurrence of the name Uselings, Old English Uth, wave, in Alfwina 1 it is written Uthlingas, with the Old English plural ending. End of note. Note 36, the shipmen of the west, emendation from Eneothrim. End of note. Well did these receive Alfwina and his pilot at the thronging quays of their harbour in the north. And it seemed to Alfwina that the man of the sea was not unknown to them, and that they held him in the greatest awe and reverence, hearkening to his requests as though they were a king's commands. Yet greater was his amaze when he met amid the throngs of that place 2 of his comrades that he had thought lost in the sea, and learnt that those 7 mariners of England were alive in that land, that the ship had been broken utterly on the black shores to the south, not long after the night when the great sea had taken Alfwina overboard. Now at the bidding of the man of the sea do those islanders with great speed fashion a new ship for Alfwina and his fellows, since he would fare no further in Orm's ship. And its timbers were cut, as the ancient sailor had asked, from a grove of magic oaks far inland that grew about a high place of the gods, sacred to Umo, lord of the sea, and seldom were any of them felled. A ship that is wrought of this wood, said the man of the sea, may be lost, but those that sail in it shall not in that voyage lose their lives. Yet may they perhaps be cast where they little think to come. But when that ship was made ready, that ancient sailor bid them climb aboard, and this they did. But with them went also Beor of the Eaglings, a man of mighty sea-craft for their aid, and one who above any of that strange folk was minded to sail at times far from the land of Eneador to west or north or south. There stood many men of the Eaglings upon the shore beside that vessel, for they had builded her in a cove of the steep shore that looked to the west, and a bar of rock with but a narrow opening made here a sheltered pool and mooring place, and few like it were to be found in that island of sheer cliffs. Then the Ancient One laid his hand upon her prow and spoke words of magic, giving her power to cleave uncloven waters and enter unentered harbors and ride untrodden beaches. Twin rudder paddles, one on either side, had she after the fashion of the Utherlings, and each of these he blessed, giving them skill to steer when the hands that held them failed, and to find lost courses and to follow stars that were hid. Then he strode away, and the press of men parted before him, until climbing he came to a high pinnacle of the cliffs. Then leapt he far out and down, and vanished with a mighty flurry of foam where the great breakers gathered to assault the towering shores. Alfwina saw him no more, and he said in grief and amaze, "Why was he thus weary of life? My heart grieves that he is dead." But the Urdlings smiled, so that he questioned some that stood nigh, saying, "Who was that mighty man? For meseems ye know him well." And they answered him nothing. And thrust they forth that vessel, valiant timbered, out into the sea, for no longer would Alfwina abide, though the sun was sinking to the mountains of Valinor beyond the western walls. Note 37. Vessel valiant timbered. Compare in the passage of alliterative verse in my father's On Translating Beowulf, The Monsters and the Critics and Other Essays, 1983, page 63, then away thrust her to voyage gladly valiant timbered. End of note. Soon was her white sail seen far away, filled with a wind from off the land, and red-stained in the light of the half-sunken sun. And those aboard her sang old songs of the English folk that faded on the sailless waves of the western seas, and now no longer came any sound of them to the watchers on the shore. Then night shut down, and none on Eneador saw that strong ship evermore. Note 38. The whole section of the narrative concerning the island of the Utherlings is more briefly told in Alfwina 1, though so far as it goes in very much the same words, with several features of the later story absent, notably the cutting of timber in the grove sacred to Ulmo, and the blessing of the ship by the man of the sea. The only actual difference of structure, however, is that whereas in Alfwina 2, Alfwina finds again his seven companions in the land of the Utherlings, and sails west with them, together with Beor of the Utherlings, in Alfwina 1, they were indeed drowned, and he got seven companions from among the Utherlings, among whom Beor is not named. End of note. So began those mariners that long and strange and perilous voyage, whose full tale has never yet been told. Naught of their adventures in the archipelagos of the West, and the wonders and the dangers that they found in the magic isles and in seas and sound unknown, are here to tell. But of the ending of their voyage, how after a time of years, sea-weary and sick of heart, they found a grey and cheerless day. Little wind was there, and the clouds hung low overhead, while a grey rain fell, and naught could any of them descry before their vessel's beak that moved now slow and uncertain over the long dead waves. That day had they trysted to be the last ere they turned their vessel homeward, if they might, save only if some wonder should betide, or any sign of hope, for their heart was gone. Behind them lay the magic isles, where three of their number slept upon dim strands in deadly sleep. And their heads were pillowed on white sand, and they were clad in foam, wrapped about in the age-long spells of Eglavine. Fruitless had been all their journeys since, for ever the winds had cast them back without sight of the shores of the island of the elves. Note 39. The plot outline Alfwina A tells the story from the point where Alfwina and his seven companions were cast on the Isle of the Man of the Sea, thus differing from Alfwina 1 and 2, where he came there alone. Thus, They wander about the island upon which they have been cast, and come upon many decaying wrecks, often of mighty ships, some treasure-laden. They find a solitary cabin beside a lonely sea, built of old shipwood, where dwells a solitary and strange old mariner of dread aspect. He tells them these are the harbourless isles whose enchanted rocks draw all ships thither, lest men fare over far upon Garsedge, see note 19, and they were devised at the hiding of Valinor. Here he says the trees are magical. They learn many strange things about the western world of him, and their desire is whetted for adventure. He aids them to cut holy trees in the island groves, and to build a wonderful vessel, and shows them how to provision it against a long voyage, that water that drieth not save when heart fails, etc. This he blesses with a spell of adventure and discovery, and then dives from a cliff-top. They suspect it was Naoth, Lord of Waters. They journey many years among strange western islands, hearing often many strange reports of the belt of magic isles which few have passed, of the trackless sea beyond where the wind bloweth almost always from the west, of the edge of the twilight and the far-glimpsed isle there standing, and its glimmering haven. They reach the magic island, Reed Islands, and three are enchanted and fall asleep on the shore. The others beat about the waters beyond and are in despair, but as often as they make headway west, the wind changes and bears them back. At last they tryst to return on the morrow if naught other happens. The day breaks chill and dull, and they lie becalmed, looking in vain through the pouring rain. This narrative differs from both Alfwina 1 and 2 in that here there is no mention of the Utherlings, and Alfwina and his seven companions depart on their long western voyage from the harbourless isle of the Ancient Mariner. It agrees with Alfwina 1 in the name Naoth, but it foreshadows 2 in the cutting of sacred trees to build a ship. End of note. Then said Alfhea, who held the helm, "Now, O Alfwina, is the trysted time. Let us do as the gods and their winds have long desired, cease from our heart-weary quest for nothingness, a fable in the void, and get us back, if the gods will it, seeking the hearths of our home." Note 40. In Alfwina 1, Alfhea does not appear, and his two speeches in this passage are there given to one Gelimer. Gelimer, Gelamir, was the name of a king of the Vandals in the 6th century. End of note. And Alfwina yielded. Then fell the wind, and no breath came from east or west, and night came slowly over the sea. Behold, at length a gentle breeze sprang up, and it came softly from the west. And even as they would fill their sails therewith for home, one of those shipmen on a sudden said, "Nay, but this is a strange air, and full of scented memories." And standing still, they all breathed deep. The mists gave before that gentle wind, and a thin moon they might see riding in its tattered shreds, until behind it soon 1,000 cool stars peered forth in the dark. "The night flowers are opening in faery," said Alfwina. "And behold," said Beor, "the elves are kindling candles in their silver dusk." And all looked whither his long hand pointed over their dark stern. Note 41. In Alfwina 1, Beor's speech is given to Gelimer, see note 40, end of note. Then none spoke for wonder and amaze, seeing deep in the gloaming of the west a blue shadow, and in the blue shadow many glittering lights, and ever more and more of them came twinkling out, until 10,000 points of flickering radiance were splintered far away, as if a dust of the jewels self-luminous that Feanor made were scattered on the lap of the ocean. "Then is that the harbour of the lights of many hues," said Alfhea, "that many a little heeded tale has told of in our homes." Then saying no more, they shot out their oars and swung about their ship in haste, and pulled towards the never-dying shore. Near had they come to abandoning it when hardly won. Little did they make of that long pull as they thrust the water strongly by them, and the long night of faery held on, and the horned moon of Elfenessel rode over them. Then came their music, very gently, over the waters, and it was laden with unimagined longing, that Alfwina and his comrades leant upon their oars and wept softly each for his heart's half-remembered hurts, and memory of fair things long lost, and each for the thirst that is in every child of men for the flawless loveliness they seek and do not find. And one said, "It is the harps that are thrumming, and the songs they are singing of fair things, and the windows that look upon the sea are full of light." And another said, "Their stringed violins complain the ancient woes of the immortal folk of earth, but there is a joy therein." "Ah me," said Alcuina, "I hear the horns of the fairies shimmering in magic woods, such music as I once dimly guessed long years ago beneath the elms of Mindongwar." And lo, as they spoke thus musing, the moon hid himself, and the stars were clouded, and the mists of time veiled the shore, and nothing could they see and naught more hear, save the sound of the surf of the seas and the far-off pebbles of the lonely isle. And soon the wind blew even that faint rustle far away. But Elfwina stood forward with wide-open eyes unspeaking, and suddenly with a great cry he sprang forward into the dark sea, and the waters that filled him were warm, and a kindly death, it seemed, enveloped him. And it seemed to the others that they awakened at his voice as from a dream, but the wind now suddenly grown fierce filled all their sails, and they saw him never again, but were driven back with hearts all broken with regret and longing. Pale elfin boats a while they would see beating home, maybe, to the haven of many hues, and they hailed them, but only faint echoes afar off were borne to their ears, and none led them ever to the land of their desire, who, after a great time, wound back all the mazy clue of their long tangled ways, until they cast anchor at last in the haven of Beleriand, aged and way-worn men. And the things they had seen and heard seemed after to them a mirage, and a fantasy born of hunger and sea spells, save only to Beor of Eneador of the ship-folk of the West. Yet among the seed of these men has there been many a restless and wistful spirit thereafter, since they were dead and passed beyond the rim of earth without need of boat or sail. But never while life lasted did they leave their seafaring, and their bodies are all covered by the sea. Note 52. Alfwina 1 ends in almost the same words as Alfwina 2, but with the most extraordinary difference. Alfwina does not leap overboard, but returns with his companions to Beleriand, and so never comes to tall Aresia. Very empty thereafter were the places of men, for Alfwina and his mariners, and of their seed have been many restless and wistful folk since they were dead. Moreover, my father seems clearly to have been going to say the same in Alfwina 2, but stopped, struck out what he had written, and introduced the sentence in which Alfwina leapt into the sea. I cannot see any way to explain this. Alfwina A ends in much the same way as Alfwina 2. As night comes on, a little breath springs up and the clouds lift. They hoist sail to return, when suddenly, low down in the dusk, they see the many lights of the haven of many hues twinkle forth. They row thither and hear sweet music. And the mist wraps all away, and the others, rousing themselves, say it is a mirage born of hunger, and with heavy hearts prepare to go back. But Alfwina plunges overboard and swims into the dark until he is overcome in the waters, and him seems death envelops him. The others sail away home and are out of the tale. End of note. The narrative ends here. There is no trace of any further continuation, though it seems likely that Alfwina of England was to be the beginning of a complete rewriting of the Lost Tales. It would be interesting to know for certain when Alfwina 2 was written. The handwriting of the manuscript is certainly changed from that of the rest of the Lost Tales, yet I am inclined to think that it followed Alfwina 1 at no great interval, and the first version is unlikely to be much later than 1920, see page 312. At the end of Alfwina 2, my father jotted down two suggestions. One, that Alfwina should be made an early pagan Englishman who fled to the west, and two, that the Isle of the Old Man should be cut out and all should be shipwrecked on Eneador, the Isle of the Utherlings. The latter would, astonishingly, have entailed the abandonment of the foundered ship, with the man of the sea thrusting it to shore on the incoming tide, and the dead Vikings lying abottom gazing at the sky. In this narrative, in which the magic of the early elves is most intensely conveyed, in the seaman's vision of the lonely isle beneath the horned moon of Elfenesse, Alfwina is still placed in the context of the figures of ancient English legend. His father is Deor the Minstrel. In the great Anglo-Saxon manuscript known as the Exeter Book, there is a little poem of 42 lines to which the title of Deor is now given. It is an utterance of the minstrel Deor, who, as he tells, has lost his place and been supplanted in his lord's favor by another bard named Heorenda. In the body of the poem, Deor draws examples from among the great misfortunes recounted in the heroic legends, and is comforted by them, concluding each allusion with the fixed refrain, Fas o Fereode, Fisses swa mag, which has been variously translated. My father held that it meant, Time has passed since then, this too can pass. Note 43. Literally, as he maintained, from that grief one moved on. From this, in the same way, one can move on. End of note. From this poem came both Deor and Heorenda. In the Ariol story, Heorenda was Ariol's son, born in Tolaresia of his wife Nymi, page 290, and was associated with Hengist and Horsa in the conquest of the Lonely Isle, page 291. His dwelling in England was at Tovarobel, page 292. I do not think that my father's Deor, the minstrel of Corterion, and Heorenda of Tovarobel can be linked more closely to the Anglo-Saxon poem than in the names alone, though he did not take the names at random. He was moved by the glimpsed tale, even if, in the words of one of the poem's editors, the autobiographical element is purely fictitious, serving only as a pretext for the enumeration of the heroic stories. And when lecturing on Beowulf at Oxford, he sometimes gave the unknown poet a name, calling him Heorenda. Nor, as I believe, can any more be made of the other Old English names in the narrative, Oswina, Prince of Gwar, Eod Gifu, Alf Hea, though the names are doubtless in themselves significant. Thus, Oswina contains Os, God, and Wina, friend. And Eod Gifu, Eod, blessedness, and Gifu, gift. The Forodwife are, of course, Viking invaders from Norway or Denmark. The name Orm of the dead ship's captain is well known in Norse. But all this is a mise-en-scène that is historical only in its bearings, not in its structure. The idea of the seven invasions of Luthien, Luthany, remained, page 314, and that of the fading and westward flight of the elves, which indeed was never finally lost. But whereas in the outlines the invasion of the Ingwaiwar, that is, the Anglo-Saxons, was the seventh, see citations 20 and 22, here the Viking invasions are portrayed as coming upon the English, nor was that the last of the takings of Luthien by men from men, page 314, obviously a reference to the Normans. Note 44. Westward flight of the elves, which indeed was never finally lost. There are long roots beneath the words of the Fellowship of the Ring, 1-2. Elves could now be seen passing westward through the woods in the evening, passing and not returning, but they were leaving Middle-earth and were no longer concerned with its troubles. That isn't anything new, if you believe the old tales, said Ted Sandyman, when Sam Gamgee spoke of the matter. End of note. There is much of interest in the geographical references in the story. At the very beginning, there is a curious statement about the breaking off of Ireland in the warfare of the gods. Seeing that the Alfwina story does not include the idea of the drawing back of Tolaresia eastwards across the sea, this must refer to something quite other than the story in 5, page 283, where the Isle of Iverin was broken off when Oser tried to wrench back Tolaresia. What this was, I do not know, but it seems conceivable that this is the first trace or hint of the great cataclysm at the end of the Elder Days, when Beleriand was drowned. I have found no trace of any connection between the harbor of Beleriand and the region of Beleriand. Corterion, Mindon Gwar, is in this tale, of course, Corterion the Old, the original elvish dwelling in Luthien, after which Corterion in Tolaresia was named. See pages 308-310. In the same way, we must suppose that the name Alal Minore, page 313, for the region about it, Warwickshire, was given anew to the midmost region of Tolaresia. Turning to the question of the islands and archipelagos in the Great Sea, what is said in Alfwina of England may first be compared with the passages of geographical description in The Coming of the Valar, 168, and The Coming of the Elves, 1-125, which are closely similar the one to the other. From these passages, we learn that there are many lands and islands in the Great Sea before the Magic Isles are reached. Beyond the Magic Isles is Tolaresia, and beyond Tolaresia are the shadowy seas, whereon there float the Twilight Isles, the first of the Outer Lands. Tolaresia itself is held neither of the Outer Lands or of the Great Lands, 1:125. It is far out in mid-ocean, and no land may be seen for many leagues sail from its cliffs, 1:121. With this account, Alfwina of England agrees closely, but to it is added now the archipelago of the Harbourless Isles. As I have noted before, 1:137, this progression from east to west of Harbourless Isles, Magic Isles, the Lonely Isle, and then the shadowy seas in which were the Twilight Isles, was afterwards changed, and it is said in the Silmarillion, page 102, that at the time of the hiding of Valinor, the Enchanted Isles were set, and all the seas about them were filled with shadows and bewilderment. And these isles were strung as a net in the shadowy seas from the north to the south, before Tolaresia, the Lonely Isle, is reached by one sailing west. Hardly might any vessel pass between them, for in the dangerous sounds the waves sighed forever upon dark rocks shrouded in mist. And in the twilight a great weariness came upon mariners and a loathing of the sea. But all that ever set foot upon the islands were there entrapped, and slept until the change of the world. As a conception, the Enchanted Isles are derived primarily from the old Magic Isles, set at the time of the hiding of Valinor, and described in that tale, 1:211. Ossa set them in a great ring about the western limits of the mighty sea, so that they guarded the Bay of Faery, and all such as stepped thereon came never thence again, but being woven in the nets of Oenen's hair, the Lady of the Sea. And whelmed in age-long slumber that Lorien set there, lay upon the margin of the waves, as those do who, being drowned, are cast up once more by the movements of the sea. Yet rather did these hapless ones sleep unfathomably, and the dark waters laved their limbs. Here three of Alfwina's companions slept upon dim strands in deadly sleep, and their heads were pillowed on white sand, and they were clad in foam, wrapped about in the age-long spells of Eglavine, page 320. I do not know the meaning of the name Eglavine, but since it clearly contains Egla, Gnomish equals Elda, see 1:251, it perhaps meant Elfenesse. But the Enchanted Isles derive also perhaps from the Twilight Isles, since the Enchanted Isles were likewise in twilight and were set in the shadowy seas, compare 1:224. And from the Harbourless Isles as well, which, as Alfwina was told by the Man of the Sea, page 317, were set at the time of the hiding of Valinor, and indeed served the same purpose as did the Magic Isles, though lying far further to the east. Eneadur, the Isle of the Utherlings, Old English Uth, wave, whose life is so fully described in Alfwina of England, seems never to have been mentioned again. Is there in Eneadur and the Shipmen of the West perhaps some faint foreshadowing of the early Numenoreans in their cliff-girt isle? The following passage, pages 316-17, is not easy to interpret. Thence, that is, from the Bay of Faery, slopes the world steeply beyond the rim of things to Valinor, that is, God-home, and to the wall and to the edge of nothingness whereon are sown the stars. In the Umbarkanta, or Shape of the World, of the 1930s, a map of the world shows the surface of the outer lands sloping steeply westwards from the mountains of Valinor. Conceivably, it is to this slope that my father was referring here, and the rim of things is the great mountain wall. But this seems very improbable. There are also references in Alfwina of England to the rim of earth, beyond which the dead pass, pages 314-322. And in an outline for The Tale of Earendel, page 260, Tuor's boat dips over the world's rim. More likely, I think, the expression refers to the rim of the horizon of men's knowledge, page 313. The expression, the sun was sinking to the mountains of Valinor beyond the western walls, page 320, I am at a loss to explain according to what has been told in the Lost Tales. A possible, though scarcely convincing interpretation, is that the sun was sinking towards Valinor, whence it would pass beyond the western walls, that is, through the door of night, see 1:215-16. Lastly, The suggestion, page 313, is notable that the elves sailing west from Lúthien might go beyond the Lonely Isle and reach even back to Valinor. On this matter, see page 280. Before ending, there remains to discuss briefly a matter of a general nature that has many times been mentioned in the texts, and especially in these last chapters, that of the diminutiveness of the elves. It is said several times in the Lost Tales that the elves of the ancient days were of greater bodily stature than they afterwards became. Thus, in The Fall of Gondolin, page 159, the fathers of the fathers of men were of less stature than men now are, and the children of Eltanessa of greater growth. In an outline for the abandoned tale of Gylfaginning, 1-235, very similarly, men were almost of a stature at first with elves, the fairies being far greater and men smaller than now. And in citation 4 in the present chapter, men and elves were formerly of a size, though men always larger.